Hi, this is the February 2024 edition of Junior Scholastic Magazine. I'm Chris Radio volunteer, Kathy Danaher. The headline on the front page of the February issue is Secrets of the Deep. Archaeologist Ayanna Flewellen is part of a group of scuba divers working to document Black history under the sea. On the front cover, there is a small photo of Ayanna, and behind her, a full-page picture of the deep blue Caribbean waters that she will be diving into and investigating. Let's turn the page, and we'll begin first with geography. Keeping this river wild. On pages 2 and 3 is a beautiful picture of the Vajosa River, Europe's first wild river national park, and a photo of the playful otters that can swim and play there. Over 1,000 plants and animals depend on the river to survive. The Vajosa River in Albania is known for its pristine blue water, but this majestic European river has a new claim to fame. Last March, the Vajosa and its tributaries became Europe's first wild river national park. A wild river is one that flows freely, untouched by human development. With its new status, the Vajosa will stay that way for the entirety of its 120-mile length in Albania. The river runs a total of 168 miles from Greece through Albania to the Adriatic Sea. For decades, the Vajosa has faced threats from dozens of proposed dam projects. The projects aim to supply the region with electricity through hydropower plants, structures that harness the energy of flowing water. But building the dams, environmentalists say, would pollute the river and harm plants and animals. The area is home to a rich variety of wildlife, including several endangered species. The national park's creation required a collaborative effort that included the Albanian government and several environmental groups. Conservationists hope the park can serve as a model for protecting other rivers around the world. Albanian Prime Minister Edi Rama hailed the protection as a truly historic moment for nature. Next, on page 4, U.S. and World News. Super Bowl payoff. Who really wins during football's biggest game? The hint is, it's not just the players. We see a picture of quarterback Patrick Mahomes holding the winning trophy. He was a player who led the Kansas City Chiefs to a Super Bowl victory in 2023 and this year in 2024. On February 11th, the top two teams in the National Football League, the NFL, will go head-to-head. But no matter which team triumphs, the contest will still be a win, and not just for the players. The Super Bowl is a huge moneymaker for TV networks, advertisers, and more. Last year's game, Super Bowl 57, averaged a record 115.1 million viewers across all broadcast platforms. Here's a look at how those eyeballs translate into cash. The chart on the bottom of the page tells us that the cost to play a Super Bowl advertisement last year was $233,333 per second. And the average total time of ads in 2023 during the big game was 50 minutes. So the advertisers made $4.60 for every dollar spent on a commercial. And if you like to snack during the game, $1.45 billion was the number of chicken wings Americans are estimated to have eaten over Super Bowl weekend. And each player on the Kansas City Chiefs football team was given a bonus of $157,000 for winning, on top of their regular salaries. Next, on page 5, under World News, a giant panda goodbye. In early November, a flight took off from Virginia carrying three VIPs, very important pandas. The beloved bears were returning home to a nature reserve in China after living at the Smithsonian's National Zoo in Washington, D.C. Mi Qing and Tian Tian, both adult giant pandas, had been on loan to the zoo since 2000. Their three-year-old cub, Chow Chi Ji, was born there. Giant pandas are endemic to China. That means they don't live in the wild anywhere else. For decades, the Asian nation has engaged in panda diplomacy, lending giant pandas to zoos in other countries to build goodwill. In return, the zoos have paid rental fees and performed research to protect the once-endangered species. The Smithsonian received its first pair of pandas in 1972. Now, Zoo Atlanta in Georgia has the only pandas left in the United States. They are due to return to China this year. For their flight home, the Smithsonian's trio traveled aboard a plane nicknamed the FedEx Panda Express. During the 19-hour trip, the pandas munched on apples, carrots, and their favorite food, bamboo. In the upper right of the page, we can see a picture of the giant panda, Tian Tian, who was one of three giant pandas at the National Zoo that flew home to China. The next article is called Hunting for the Truth. When you picture a hunter from thousands of years ago, what do you imagine? For a long time, anthropologists thought men hunted while women gathered, but that assumption was likely wrong. In 2018, archaeologists found an ancient hunting kit with weapons alongside the bone fragments of a woman in Peru. That prompted them to recheck findings from other burials. Their conclusion? Big game hunting between 8,000 and 14,000 years ago was actually gender neutral. A new review of existing research also supports that conclusion. It's a natural thing to have assumptions, researcher Sophia Chilczuk told the New York Times, but it's our responsibility to challenge those assumptions to better understand our world. On the bottom of page 5, we see a drawing of a woman hunter and what she might have looked like as she held a spear, hiding behind a boulder and hunting for wild game thousands of years ago. And we move on now to page 6, under World News, Growing Up in a War Zone. This month marks the 2-year anniversary of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Here's how young people in this war-torn country are finding hope amid the fighting. On page 6, across from the map of the battle for Ukraine, is a photo of a young boy in the town of Irpin, Ukraine, riding a hoverboard past buildings that were destroyed by war. What is a typical morning like for you? Maybe you wake up in a warm bed and pop a bagel into the toaster for breakfast. Then you grab your fully charged phone and head to school to catch up with your friends before the first bell. This may sound like just another ordinary day in your life, but in Ukraine, where war has raged for 2 years, many teens can only dream of this kind of normalcy. That's because nearly every aspect of their lives was turned upside down on February 24, 2022. Early that morning, Russia launched a full-scale assault on Ukraine. Missiles rained down on Ukrainian military bases and cities, and Russian troops and tanks poured into the Eastern European nation from the north and east. The Ukrainian military was immediately deployed. The two sides have been fighting within Ukraine ever since. The ongoing conflict has caused great suffering. Roughly 200,000 Ukrainian troops have been killed or wounded in the fighting as of this past fall. And at least 10,000 Ukrainian civilians have been killed, according to the United Nations. In addition, about 6 million people have fled the country to escape the violence. For the 37 million residents who remain in Ukraine, nearly half needed urgent humanitarian aid, such as food and shelter, as of this past December. At times, families have had to do without heat and electricity, and millions of students have been shut out of classrooms. In addition, countless others are staying isolated at home for safety, leaving them disconnected from friends and family. How are the children and teens of Ukraine coping? Turn the page to learn about some of the challenges they face because of the war and how they are overcoming them. The next article is entitled, Coming Together to Overcome Loneliness. Artem Korshin, 18, is a college student at a university in Kyiv, Ukraine's capital. But Kyiv is frequently targeted by airstrikes, so Artem now takes his classes online from his hometown of Khorostashiv, which is somewhat safer. Still, the stress of the war has taken its toll on Artem, and the fact that he can't be around his peers at school has made it worse, eliminating the moments of connection that once brightened his days. Even if the missiles don't kill me, they still strike the inner part of me that wants to live, not just exist, he says. Artem is not alone. Studies show that the loss and disruption caused by war make people more prone to mental health problems, particularly children and teens, who thrive on routine. An estimated 1.5 million young people in Ukraine are at risk of depression and other mental health issues because of the war, according to the United Nations Children's Fund, called UNICEF. What's more, experts say that people who live in war zones are often under constant stress. They may have witnessed loved ones being injured or killed, or they may have lost their homes. Artem recognized that many of his peers in Ukraine likely felt like he did, or worse. So, he decided to take action in October 2022. He helped establish a youth center in Khorostashiv. The space provides a place for teens to connect. Artem helped set up the youth center through a UNICEF initiative called Upshift. The program provides teens with skills and funding to help solve problems in their communities. About 200 teens now use the center to study and play games. They also do art therapy, which experts say can help people process difficult emotions. But most important to Artem, many teens are making new friends there, including him. We still need to socialize, he says. Having someone you can talk to is crucial during such challenging times. You realize that you're not alone. On page 9, the picture in the upper right part of the page is of a young teen, Vladislav, whose home in Ukraine can lose electricity for hours or even days at a time during Russian airstrikes. Next, the article is called Fighting for Light and Warmth. In the spring of 2022, Vladislav, 16, and his family fled their home in Irpin, Ukraine, as Russian troops stormed into the city. When they returned a few months later, their house had been destroyed. The family found a new place to live in Irpin, but their crisis was not over. With winter coming, Russia began attacking Ukraine's infrastructure, which are the basic systems and structures that help a country function. Thousands of missiles and drones struck power plants across the nation, knocking out electricity, heat, and hot water for millions. Suddenly, much of Ukraine, including Irpin, was plunged into frigid darkness. but Vladislav's family happened to have a generator. That is a device that can convert fuel into electricity. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has said that generators are as important as armor when it comes to protecting residents. Vladislav used his generator for warmth and even to study. "To charge a phone, we have to switch on the generator," he said. "Our teachers send us homework over an app." Since that first winter at war, most of Ukraine's infrastructure has been repaired. But when this issue went to press, winter was setting in once again, and Russia was ramping up attacks on Ukraine's power plants. However, people around the world are rallying to help. The U.S. has sent Ukraine weapons to shoot down Russian drones, and aid groups are donating generators and warm clothes. Even teens are stepping up. In British Columbia, Canada, students at Oak Bay High School recently learned how Ukrainians suffer during winter. That inspired them to take part in a community fundraiser. Their goal is to raise $20,000 to buy two generators for Ukrainians. Regine Warren, a 10th grader involved with the effort, is determined to succeed. "As long as we get the word out," she told reporters, "we can come together and do this." On the bottom of the page in the information box, we read, "Why did Russia invade Ukraine?" For centuries, Russian leaders have tried to make Ukraine part of a larger empire. All along, Ukrainians have struggled to maintain their own identity. In 1922, Ukraine was forced to be a part of the Soviet Union, a giant communist country dominated by Russia. In 1991, the Soviet Union broke apart into 15 separate nations, including Ukraine and Russia. Russian President Vladimir Putin does not recognize Ukraine as a nation. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has worked to form a closer relationship with the United States and other Western countries. This has angered Putin, who believes that Ukraine should be allied with Russia instead. Many of those Western countries have supplied money and weapons to Ukraine to aid in its fight. U.S. officials say that Putin wants to remove Zelensky from power and replace him with a leader who would be loyal to Russia. According to military experts, Putin probably expected to win the war quickly because Ukraine is a much smaller country than Russia. But 2 years later, Ukraine is still defending itself and no end to the war is in sight. Turning to page 10, we read about finding a safe place to learn in a subway station. This article is about Ukraine students who attend school underground in a subway station. On the upper right of the page is a picture of classrooms that are set up in utility rooms just a few feet away from the trains. Every so often during the school day, the walls of Alina Barsuk's classroom vibrate, and the voice of her algebra teacher is temporarily drowned out. An underground train is rumbling past, just feet away from the class. But Alina doesn't mind. The 8th grader is one of about 1,000 students in Kharkiv, Ukraine, who attend school below ground, in a subway station. Education officials created the voluntary program at the start of the school year as a way to get students back into the classrooms while still protecting them from the near constant threat of Russian airstrikes. Kharkiv, with about 1.4 million people, is less than 25 miles from the Russian border. A missile from Russia can reach the city in less than a minute. Not enough time for students in above-ground classrooms to race to bomb shelters. For this reason, all in-person learning in Kharkiv was effectively canceled when the war began. Across Ukraine, education systems are facing similar challenges. According to the UN, more than 1,300 of the country's 17,000 schools have been destroyed. Thousands of others have been damaged. UNICEF estimates that more than 5 million students in Ukraine have fallen behind academically, in part because many of them no longer have access to in-person learning. To address the crisis in Kharkiv, officials there built dozens of classrooms in 5 subway stations. The learning spaces are set up near where trains arrive and depart. Students in grade 1 through 11 attend the classes in person 2 or 3 days a week. The rest of the time, they continue their learning from home. Many experts say in-person learning is critical during a war. A classroom setting allows students to better grasp the material, and it gives young people an opportunity to be with their peers. It also provides a sense of routine amid great uncertainty. Yet, only about 1/3 of Ukrainian kids and teens are able to attend school in person full-time. Alina, 14, is happy to be inside a classroom. "I wanted to go back to school for a long time," she told reporters. "There are other teens to talk to, and you see the teacher in person." Yegor Rostrogui, an 11th grader, agrees. "After 2 years of online classes, it's really nice to come here and see people's eyes." On page 11, U.S. News, "Inspiring Teens Leading the Charge." Serena Hal Tamana, 14, has helped recycle 350,000 batteries. Why is that so important? Read on to learn how this New Jersey teen came up with a simple solution to a global problem. On the right side of the page is a photo of Nahal holding up a poster saying, "Recycle batteries today for a better tomorrow." When he was just 10 years old, Sheree Nahal Tamana watched a story on the news that completely shocked him. A discarded battery had exploded at a waste disposal plant in California, sparking a huge fire. The massive blaze caused millions of dollars in damage. "It was just horrific," says Nahal, now 14. "That's when I decided to take action." A staggering 15 billion batteries end up in landfills each year, with the potential to leak dangerous chemicals or catch on fire. The teen from New Jersey made it his mission to stop that from happening. In 2019, Nahal founded Recycle My Battery, a nonprofit that collects and recycles used batteries. Today, the group has about 550 volunteers, mostly kids and teens, throughout the United States and in 4 other countries. Together, they've recycled more than 350,000 batteries. Knowing we're making a real difference motivates our team to push even harder for responsible battery disposal, Nahal says. And batteries aren't just a problem after they're tossed out. The process of making batteries can harm the environment too, experts say. Batteries create electric power through chemical reactions, as they need minerals such as lithium and cobalt to do it. Those minerals are found deep underground in countries such as the Democratic Republic of the Congo in Africa and Chile in South America. The digging and drilling from mining releases toxic minerals that pollute the air, water, and soil. That harms plants and animals in the area, as well as the food supply of local residents. Many of the batteries made with those minerals are designed for single use. When they are thrown away, they disintegrate, and the chemicals inside can seep out in landfills, contaminating soil and groundwater. rechargeable batteries pose an additional threat. The lithium-ion batteries in cell phones, laptops, and other electronic devices store a lot of energy in a small space. If damaged, they can overheat and start a fire, says Brian O'Connor. He is an engineer with the National Fire Protection Association. The risk of that happening is higher in landfills, where heavy machines pack down layers of trash. From 2013 to 2020, at least 245 fires in the U.S. waste facilities were caused by batteries with lithium in them, according to the Environmental Protection Agency. In fact, a lithium-ion battery ignited the blaze that first caught Nihal's attention. Nihal wants to reduce the risk of such fires and cut down on the amount of new minerals that need to be mined. He started by going door to door, handing out flyers about the importance of recycling batteries. But batteries can't just be put in a household recycling bin. They need to go to facilities equipped to safely handle battery waste. So, Nihal began collecting used batteries. He then took them to a battery drop-off site at local electronic and office supply stores. Soon he was collecting more than those sites could even manage. That's when Nihal reached out to Call to Recycle, the largest battery recycling nonprofit in North America. Call to Recycle agreed to provide battery bins and to recycle the batteries that Nihal's group collected. Recycle My Battery began putting the bins in schools and libraries, and Nihal started recruiting more kids to help. The bins come in two sizes, with the small ones holding up to 300 batteries and the large ones up to 500. Once the bins are full, they are sent to Call to Recycle, which sorts the batteries by type. Then, they are recycled to make new batteries and other products. Since 2019, Nihal and his team have distributed more than 550 battery bins. Recycle My Battery also educates people about how to recycle batteries and why it matters. To spread the word, Nihal uses social media and speaks at school assemblies. Volunteers in India, Canada, Switzerland, and the United Arab Emirates have helped him take his message worldwide. People know how to recycle plastic or trash properly, Nihal says, but nobody knows about batteries. He's also raising awareness in other creative ways. In October 2023, Recycle My Battery broke a Guinness World Record for the longest line of batteries. More than 100 volunteers helped Nihal place 31,204 used batteries in a single line at the elementary school he attended in Edison, New Jersey. Afterward, they sent the batteries to Call to Recycle. For his work, Nihal has been honored with numerous awards. Recently, he was among the three finalists for the 2023 International Children's Peace Prize. With the popularity of electronics and electric vehicles on the rise, the demand for lithium-ion batteries will likely continue to grow. Nihal says Recycle My Battery will keep expanding too. We're building a community that values environmental stewardship, he says, one battery at a time. The information box at the top of page 12 shows four important steps on how batteries are produced and then sold to consumers. This is an interesting process to read and discuss with your teachers, and also how you can help recycle your used batteries. On page 14, Sunken History. Archaeologist Ayanna Fluellen records lost ships from the slave trade as a scuba diver for an organization called Diving with a Purpose. The full-page photo of Ayana shows her in scuba gear, filming a shipwreck and gathering information on the bottom of the Caribbean Sea. Beneath the waves of the Atlantic Ocean lies a history that's been hidden for centuries, that of ships that sank while carrying enslaved Africans to the Americas. Between the 1500s and the 1860s, hundreds of such vessels were lost to the sea, and with them, the lives and stories of the people who had been forced on board. Ayana Fluellen's mission is to help uncover and share those tales. Fluellen is an archaeologist, a scientist who researches human history by studying objects people leave behind. During the school year, Fluellen is a professor at Stanford University in California. In the summer, though, the co-founder of the Society of Black Archaeologists puts on a wetsuit and fins as part of a nonprofit called Diving with a Purpose, or DWP. The DWP helps map shipwrecks, including those of sunken slave ships, along major routes. The group trains volunteer scuba divers, mostly of African descent, in the basics of underwater archaeology. Then, the divers work to document the wrecks, which have already started disintegrating before they disappear. Through the work, Fluellen says Black divers find and tell their own histories, ones that don't always appear in books. Since 2016, Fluellen has completed more than 50 dives, everywhere from the Caribbean Sea to Alabama's Mobile River. Here, Fluellen shares what it's like to take a deep dive into the past. "I was not familiar with scuba diving in the slightest," she said, "but I grew up in Miami, Florida, by the Atlantic Ocean and Gulf of Mexico. I have a lot of memories of going to Crandon Park, which is a historically African-American beach, and snorkeling with my mother and my grandmother. It wasn't until a colleague came back from his first dive with DWP that I became interested. His eyes were so wide with excitement that I was like, 'All right, let me see.' It changed my entire life. It was in St. Croix. I saw everything from huge purple sea fans to ship anchors stuck in coral reefs. It was a beautiful experience to see the vibrancy of the sea life, and also to feel the vastness of the ocean around me." She was asked, "How does DWP find the shipwrecks?" "We often partner with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, called NOAA. It oversees several hundred wreck sites, but doesn't have enough staff to document all of them. A NOAA archaeologist usually gives us the historical background of a particular site, as well as the GPS coordinates, so we can find it." She was asked, "What happens during a dive?" The lead divers lay a line of measuring tape from one end of a wrecking site to the other end. We use that line to divide the site. Then, a pair of divers is assigned to each section. We take measurements of everything in our area. "When I first began, we used tape measures. But recently, to speed up the process, we've been diving with the underwater GoPro cameras. We take thousands of images of each section. Later, computer software puts together the images, like puzzle pieces. This creates a detailed map of the entire wreck site. On a typical project, we spend 2 days getting the background information, 3 or 4 days in the water, and then a day afterward, mapping. We find fragments of plates, glass beads that were used for trading, metal pieces, and of course, the ships, which are themselves artifacts. In 2021, we did a dive to an 18th century wooden schooner, one of the oldest ships recovered in the waters near St. John. We found the glass bottle that was likely produced in the mid-18th century. We know that because of the shape of the bottle. Those kinds of artifacts are really exciting because they help give you a date for the wreck itself. Archaeologists who do marine work quite literally have to train their eyes to see differently. For instance, the metal you recover underwater is often covered in coral and teeming with different kinds of life around it. That makes your work that much more important. You're documenting not only the cultural significance of a site, but its environmental significance as well. Oftentimes, creating a map is the main objective because we don't want to disturb the sea life by removing artifacts. NOAA uses the maps to track the area over time. For example, are there changes from one hurricane season to the next? Or is it due to an increase in tourism? One shipwreck I worked on was the Clotilda in Mobile, Alabama. That was the last known slave ship to arrive in the United States in 1860. The goal was to get fragments of the ship for a museum. But if there isn't a plan for properly preserving an object, it makes more sense to photograph or draw it and leave it in place. Once these artifacts are no longer saturated with water, they can break down rapidly. The question asked, how do you handle the feelings that come with exploring sunken slave ships? When I'm overcome with sadness, I let that emotion come and I sit with it. The history is hard, and being able to sit with it, breathe with it underwater, is healing. It allows me to acknowledge the injury that this history has on me and the larger country. I know that I'm doing something that allows us to chart a path forward. People feel more connected to the past when they can physically see the remains of it. Being able to uncover the remains of a ship that carried enslaved Africans across the Atlantic brings that history close to us. In the information box on the upper right of page 17, the middle passage states, from the 16th to 19th century, 12.5 million Africans were captured and forced into European slave ships. They were transported across the Atlantic Ocean to be sold in the Americas. That journey was known as the Middle Passage. Men, women, and children were put in chains and packed into the ships for weeks or even months. Many of the captured Africans tried to revolt. Still, they suffered brutal abuse, starvation, and diseases caused by the inhumane conditions on board. An estimated 1.8 million African people died on the crossing. Those who survived were enslaved in North and South America, where they were subjected to even more cruelty and violence. An estimated 35,000 voyages were attempted across the Middle Passage. At least 1,000 ships sank along the way. Few of those shipwrecks have been found. The question was asked, what skills or qualities make a diver good at this? The amount of time I've spent learning how to do this work is definitely a qualifier. My first archaeological dig was in 2008. My first dive was in 2016, and I graduated with my PhD in anthropology in 2018. A PhD is the highest academic degree. Additionally, I am a lover of history and detail. Archaeology, whether on land or underwater, requires that you pay attention to details. She was asked, what advice do you have for teens interested in marine archaeology? Get into the water. Start in your region. Is there a local beach or river cleanup that you can join? Our waterways are waiting for people like you to explore their wonders. On page 18, debate. Should you have to pass a civics test to graduate? You've spent countless hours on math homework, written essays for language arts, and even performed a few science experiments. But have you learned enough civics? Civics focuses on the rights and responsibilities of citizens. It encompasses everything from why our country was formed to how our government works. Many people say understanding civics is a key for successful democracy because it instills the importance of voting, staying informed, being active in your community, and following laws. That's why people applying to become U.S. citizens must pass a civics test. Its 100 questions cover a range of U.S. history, government, law, and geography topics. For instance, applicants must know when the U.S. Constitution was written, identify at least one freedom protected by the First Amendment, and be able to name the current president. But a civics test requirement isn't just for new citizens. Over the past decade, there has been a growing movement to give the test to high school students, too. In at least 15 states, students must pass a version of the test to graduate, and at least two other states are considering similar requirements. Does mandating that students pass a civics test help create informed and engaged citizens? Or does it put too much emphasis on memorizing facts and not enough on teaching teens to be active members of society? Read what two experts have to say, then decide what you think. First, the yes opinion. Yes, the test ensures students will learn about civics. Former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor once said, "The practice of democracy is not passed down through the gene pool. It must be taught and learned anew by each generation of citizens." O'Connor understood how important it is to teach civics. Without it, young people aren't prepared to actively participate in our government. Over the past few decades, American high schools have been focused on preparing students for reading and math tests that students must pass to graduate. As a result, less time has been devoted to civics education. The effect is a shocking lack of understanding about how our government works. A 2023 Annenberg Public Policy Center survey found that 17% of Americans couldn't name any of the three branches of the federal government. O'Connor called this lack of basic knowledge about civics a quiet crisis. We must address it. Civics education can help our country counter misinformation and misunderstanding. Fake information spreads rapidly online, and people argue over politics. A better background in civics can help citizens filter out inaccurate information and debate controversial subjects civilly. The unfortunate reality is that unless there is a way to measure civics education, it will not be a priority in schools. We must require students to pass a test showing their mastery of civics before they graduate. It is the best way to ensure that all young people are taught this critical material. This was stated by Elizabeth Evans, Civic Education Program Director from Arizona State University. And in the No column, memorizing facts doesn't create engaged citizens. The questions on the U.S. citizenship test can easily be answered by memorization. Passing the test does little to prepare young people for a thoughtful civic and political engagement, one of the primary aims of civics education. For example, one question on the test asks how many times the U.S. Constitution has been amended. It's pretty easy to memorize the number 27. In fact, too easy. High-quality civics education must go deeper. It should help students understand different points of view on current constitutional and political issues. and it needs to teach teens how to talk civilly about those topics with people who disagree with them. Even a perfect score on the citizenship exam wouldn't help with either goal. Some may ask, if it's so easy to memorize the answers to 100 questions, what's the harm in the test? The problem is that many teachers feel pressure to tailor their teaching to high-stakes tests that are required for graduation. And if you can't graduate without passing such a test, the stakes are very high indeed. The test material will end up crowding out the much more important and much more challenging aspects of civics education. We should not waste students' time requiring them to memorize a list. Instead, we should ensure that all students receive a high-quality civics education that gives them deeper knowledge, connects civics to their lives, and inspires them to participate politically and civically in the first place. This by Diana Hess, Dean of the School of Education, the University of Wisconsin, Madison. And on page 20, under World History, the Lost City of Pompeii. Nearly 2,000 years ago, a massive eruption buried an ancient Roman city. Scientists are still digging up clues about its fascinating history. On page 20 is a picture of what the city of Pompeii may have looked like, with a sky covered with dark gray clouds of smoke and flames leaping out of Mount Vesuvius in the background. It came with little warning. The ground shook violently. Then a thunderous explosion of molten rock and ash shot into the sky, unleashing a cloud of destruction so enormous that it blotted out the sun. It was August 24th, 79 AD, and Mount Vesuvius, on Italy's western coast, was erupting. For the people who had long lived in its shadow, the eruption was unlike anything they had ever seen. In fact, they didn't even have a word for volcano in Latin, which was their language. Within hours, one of the most popular vacation spots in the ancient world would be lost. And 2,000 people would be dead. At about noon on August 24th, the people of Pompeii were going about their day as usual. Pompeii was a bustling port city and seaside resort with a population of about 12,000. On the stone streets, vendors sold melon and roasted mice stuffed with nuts and chopped pork. Marble workers chiseled stone statues of famous emperors and warriors. People painted announcements in bright red letters for upcoming elections and theater performances. Factories churned out fabrics for clothes and leather goods. Pompeii was a jewel in the heart of the Roman Empire, a civilization that at that time stretched across most of Europe, North America, and part of Western Asia. Traders from across the empire came to Pompeii to buy and sell their goods. And, like most Roman cities, Pompeii boasted advanced infrastructure, such as its water supply system. Aqueducts carried fresh water through underground tunnels to stone fountains, bathhouses, and homes. About 5 miles from Pompeii rose the majestic Mount Vesuvius, towering over this lively metropolis. But no one knew what Vesuvius truly was, that beneath its gentle green slopes was a lake of magma, or molten rock. After all, it hadn't erupted in more than 1,500 years. Now, however, the magma was rising up inside Vesuvius. Intense pressure was building. And then, boom! As the volcano erupted, thousands in Pompeii fled in panic. Others took shelter within the city. But falling pumice, volcanic rock, was raining down with such deadly force, roofs collapsed over their heads. The nightmare went on for hours, Shortly before midnight, Vesuvius exploded again, triggering a surge of ash and hot gas that moved at speeds of more than 100 miles per hour. No one could escape it. The surge swallowed Pompeii. By the next night, the ash had cooled and hardened like concrete, sealing the city like a tomb. Pompeii had vanished. The once thriving city was lost to history for more than 1,500 years. So, how do we know so much about Pompeii today? In 1748, the ruins of Pompeii were unearthed, sparking excavation projects that have continued there ever since. It turns out the very ash and pumice that destroyed Pompeii also preserved it nearly perfectly. Vesuvius froze the city in time. For more than 250 years, archaeologists have been slowly digging out the ancient city from as much as 20 feet of volcanic ash and rock. And with each discovery, they learn more about what life was like in the Roman Empire. Indeed, the ruins of Pompeii have provided the most detailed picture of an ancient Roman city ever found. Houses, shops, and temples have emerged from the layers, revealing thousands of frescoes or paintings on their plaster walls. Surprisingly, archaeologists found intact loaves of bread and eggs still in their shells. They also uncovered an amphitheater, a stadium that could seat 20,000 spectators. Then there are Pompeii's dead. After the eruption, ash hardened around their bodies. As they decayed, hollow shells of their figures were left behind. Scientists filled the shells with plaster, creating casts that bear haunting witness to the final moments of so many of the city's inhabitants. Today, the ruins of Pompeii are extremely fragile. Over the years, this site has been hit by multiple earthquakes, bombs during World War II, 1939 to 1945, and countless floods. In recent years, heavy rainfall has put Pompeii's delicate buildings at risk of crumbling. The good news is that an ambitious $145 million project is underway to preserve the ruins and continue excavations. At least one-third of Pompeii is still buried. It's called the Great Pompeii Project, and since it began in 2012, much progress has been made. Archaeologists recently shared their discoveries of a fresco featuring what looks to be a pizza. They also uncovered a bakery prison where donkeys and enslaved men were made to live and work, milling flour for bread. In the past, people were mostly fascinated by the rich, says Stephen Ellis, one of the archaeologists at Pompeii. But, he says, these days researchers are focusing on the lives of Pompeii's ordinary residents, and they have many questions. How diverse was Pompeii? What was life like for the city's enslaved people? For the children? For persons with disabilities? You walk over it, and you know that underneath your feet there is still so much that future generations will be able to discover, says Alice. What secrets has Pompeii yet to reveal? On the top of page 23 is a photo of the ruins of the buildings that have been excavated, with a very quiet Mount Vesuvius in the background. On the bottom of the page, in the information box, is a copy of a letter that was written by a teenager known as Pliny the Younger, who watched Mount Vesuvius erupt from across the Bay of Naples. It is the only surviving eyewitness account. We stood still in the midst of a dangerous and dreadful scene. the sea seemed to roll back on itself. On the other side, a black and dreadful cloud. Broken with rapid zigzag flashes, revealed masses of flame. Night came upon us, not such as we have when there is no moon, but that of a room when it is shut up, and all the lights put out. I might boast that not a sigh or expression of fear escaped me, had not my support been grounded in that miserable, though mighty consolation that all mankind was involved in the same calamity, and that I was perishing with the world itself. That's it for this installment of Junior Scholastic. I'm Kathy Danaher, Chris Volunteer. So long, until next month.